You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 17th, 2014, Beth Parnitza presented the fifth and final lecture in our Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. How does a culture view its past, and how does it present itself through a museum format? How do we understand our society through its museum exhibits? This and many other questions on how we perceive the American Civil War are answered in this interesting podcast. Beth Parnitza is an historian with the National Park Service at the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, where she supervises the Chancellorsville Battlefield Center and manages volunteers and social media. A 2011 graduate of West Virginia University, her interests focus largely on the human element of the Civil War, particularly in understanding the steps taken by individuals toward a harder kind of war and their motivations to do so. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses, Modern Memory and Material Culture. Here's Beth Parnitza.
So I want to say thank you, first of all, to all of you for having me back a fourth time. I really am honored to be able to speak with you yet again, and I hope that you'll bear with me and put up with me for one more time. But I want to say thanks also to one of my colleagues, Eric Mink, for providing a lot of the research that I'll be using today, especially his work on early museum collections. So most of it is mine, some of it is his, so thanks to him for allowing me to borrow it. Now the topic tonight, you see my title is Modern Memory and Material Culture, which is a title that generally doesn't make much sense. So let me explain a little bit about what we're going to be talking about. Our goal tonight, of course, is to see the Civil War through a different lens. So my hope is that we'll be able to get a bit of an understanding of how a culture views its past through how that culture organizes and then presents its past in a museum form. So how do we understand a society through its museum exhibits? Which is a strange sort of way to understand a society. But if you'll bear with me, promise it'll make more sense. So our view of the Civil War, all of our views of the Civil War, is really colored by our impressions, how it's been presented to us, whether it's from our earliest childhood. Rick was telling me earlier today about how much he remembers the dioramas that he saw in our visitor center years and years ago. Not, of course, that long ago. But from his childhood, he still remembers the dioramas that he saw on display, and that certainly has colored how he views the Civil War through time. It really tends to fit into the boxes that we create through our own mindset, and we do this a lot, especially in terms of talks. We focus on one subject, and we kind of try to push the others to the side, and we are almost forced to do this when we create exhibits. So you have a short amount of time, you've got a short attention span to deal with, and you're trying to fit a very, very large, multifaceted story into a small place, often behind glass. So the questions that we ask, the subjects that we address in exhibits, are guided somewhat by logistical concerns and then also by the way that we view the Civil War, the way that we view the Civil War changes through time. So the way that we as a society collectively viewed the Civil War, say in the 1960s, is very different from how we look at it today. So that's some of what we'll be looking at. But we're going to start with a bit of a story to look at an artifact and to see just how many things an artifact can tell us. So, if you'll start us. All right. So this artifact is just a rolling pin. It seems like a pretty everyday average artifact. You're missing the handles, which by the end of the story, I think you'll all have several theories on how those handles went missing. But it's just a rolling pin. When we start to look at an artifact, there's a lot of different ways that we can look at it. There's a lot of questions that we can ask an artifact. We don't want to use it just for illustrative purposes, to just say, well, this is a rolling pin of the Civil War era. We can use it that way, but there's so much more to the story. So I want to ask you all, what sort of questions would you want to know? What comes to mind when you're looking at this artifact?
Who's rolling pin?
All right, that's one of the biggest. What else? Where was it found? Where did it come from? All right.
Was it used to
what kind of wood is it?
Was it used to strike somebody?
Was it used to strike somebody? That's going to be one of the things left up to interpretation. Not to my knowledge was it used to strike anybody. There are people in the story who potentially deserve to be struck, however. All right, so those are some of the really basic questions that we would ask of an artifact, mostly fact-based. We want to know whose it was, because that tells us wealth of information about the artifact. But we also want to know where it came from, what it's made of, some very concrete kind of questions. And then you can branch out into the more complex questions, asking what did this artifact mean to the person who owned it? How did it survive through the years? How does its current condition reflect its use through the years? What can this item then, to get very big picture, what can this item tell us about a person or a society at large? What does this rolling pin tell us about Civil War era people? And there's always a chance that it tells us nothing. But there's a chance it can tell us a little bit more. How does this rolling pin show us change or national trends? And so one of the interesting things about artifacts is that they can't lie to you. So human beings, when they're writing on paper, they can definitely lie, and a lot of times they do. Or they stretch the truth, or they're seeing it through their own perspective, and it's not the same as your perspective, and the person right next to them might see something absolutely different. But this artifact can't lie to you. There's also a lot of things it can't tell you. So there's a difference also between truth, which this artifact will always tell you the truth, and then your interpretation of that truth. So I can tell you that this is made of wood, but how far does that get us? Just to know that this rolling pin is made of wood. So we need to understand a little bit more about the backstory. We need to understand the big picture. We need to understand also how people shape the artifacts that they own. So whether it's just by keeping this rolling pin through the years, whether it's by cutting the handles off because they didn't fit in a box, or breaking the handles off over someone's head, whatever may have happened to this artifact, the people who owned it or used it shaped it through the years, even through its very existence. I think I saw a question.
Well, I'm sorry yes. to ask the question. Photograph is wonderful, and it's up close. You don't have anything to recognize the size. At first, I thought it was much bigger until you mentioned the rolling pin, and then I saw where the handle was.
That's a good point. This is actually on a table. So this is a small picture. We do have another view that we'll look at later. Unless we want to, we can actually just go on to it. Which actually shows you even less of its dimensions. So an excellent point that I was going more for a close-up, it's true. But part of that was to show you the details of it because I don't actually have it with me, unfortunately. But in any case, this rolling pin serves to us at the moment as the sort of quintessential symbol of domestic life, right? You need this rolling pin in order to bake. And this rolling pin, so that we can start to broaden our story a little bit, belonged to Permelia Higgerson. Those of you who were present for my talk about the wilderness, Higgerson might ring a bell, but for anyone that it doesn't, Permelia Higgerson lived on the wilderness battlefield, or what became the wilderness battlefield. She was 34 years old in 1864. She was the daughter of William and Permelia Tuning, who lived next door in Mount View, which is, again, right nearby on the wilderness battlefield. Her household consisted initially of her husband Benjamin, 5 children, and 2 slaves. Her husband, interestingly living next door to his in-laws, not an enviable position, was 52 years old when he died, and he died December 25th, Christmas Day, 1862. He had contracted smallpox from a wounded Confederate soldier that Permelia and he had allowed to recuperate in their home. So even though war had not yet come to the Higgerson house, it had already struck home at the household of Benjamin and Permelia Higgerson. After the death of her husband and her home later being run over by soldiers during the Battle of the Wilderness, she moves firstly to Parkersburg, West Virginia. She became one of us. And then on to New Madrid, which I've been told I'm mispronouncing, so anyone from Missouri can correct me. But to New Madrid, how do you say it? Rick, you're nodding. Madrid. New Madrid, Missouri. And in Missouri, Permelia, who had remarried, had a bit of a personal tragedy in which, yet another one, in which her husband, William Porter, who was a teacher, ran off with Permelia's daughter from her first marriage, Jacqueline, with whom he later had four children as part of her common law marriage. This is a lady who's seen a lot of life. Through all of these changes, the rolling pin stuck with her, or she stuck with the rolling pin. The rolling pin made the journey all the way from Virginia to Missouri, and then was passed down through the family as an item that belonged to Permelia, as this sort of token of Virginia that was still with them. And so perhaps this was entirely a functional rolling pin as the reason that it was kept, because of course you're not going to ditch your rolling pin and then buy a new one in Missouri. She kept it. She probably didn't have the disposable income in order to do otherwise. But as the years pass, this probably begins to take on a different meaning. This is a token of home, home being Virginia, where she was born and raised. So this is a reminder, perhaps, of that home, of her first husband, who did not run off with a daughter. And so today, though, it speaks to us of a civilian whose life is overrun by war. And so you can see how we go from a very basic rolling pin to this much broader story about Permelia Higgerson and her life. But this artifact has told us one facet of it. It told us about Permelia's domestic life, about how she sort of suffered through her life. But there's a lot more to Permelia Higgerson, as there is to each of us. Everyone has a multifaceted personality. And so to better construct Permelia, let's look at one more artifact. So I have a question for all the ladies in the crowd. How many of you have ever or have ever considered smoking a pipe? I'm not raising my hand because I actually have. I'm just raising my hand. All right, so so far I've got two men. Ladies, any of you? No, you're giving me incredulous looks. Yeah, I wouldn't either. Permelia, however, would and did. And so this can tell us a little bit maybe about her place in society, her overall economic well-being. Your high-class ladies certainly did not tend to smoke a pipe, but there are several of your lower-class ladies who would have. A couple of different examples I know, even just from the home sites in our park. But Permelia is a pretty tough lady. And so this pipe gives us, which, by the way, is supposedly the last pipe that she ever smoked, which tells me she had multiple. This lady is a tougher sort of lady. She's a lower-class lady who doesn't just suffer when the army comes to call. So we're often used to seeing her portrait. If you want to go ahead and turn the slides. This is Permelia. Now, I always feel badly for Permelia. This is clearly a portrait taken of her later in life. Remember that during the Battle of the Wilderness, she was only 34 years old. She probably didn't look quite like this. And so by the time this picture is taken, remember that she's lost her first husband. She's seen her yard trampled over by soldiers and her home destroyed. Her husband has quite likely already run off with her daughter from her first marriage. So I have a feeling that I would look an awful lot like Permelia also if those circumstances were in line. But we see in her portrait, again, a very, very tough-looking lady. But this is Permelia, and this is her home on the wilderness battlefield. And when the Battle of the Wilderness came to her home, Company D of the 149th Pennsylvania ran right through her garden. They trampled the fence. They trampled her garden. How would you feel in her shoes? What was that? Get the rolling pin. All right. So I have heard it suggested that perhaps the handles broke off when she beat up some Union soldiers. But unfortunately, there are no Union soldier accounts of them being beaten with a rolling pin. However, they do recount Permelia's greeting to them. And they said, "A Virginia woman stood in the cabin door and gave us her views on matters in strong language. She declared that we were a pack of cowardly Yankees, that we would not go far in that direction, and we would soon come back in a hurry. We didn't pay much attention to what she said, but the result proved that she was right, at least so far as the coming back was concerned." And the men were, in fact, driven back soon thereafter. And they wrote, "Our lady friend greeted us as we passed with taunts and derision. But we had no time to discuss the matter. In fact, she had the best of it, as we were whipped for that time and she knew it." It takes a tough person to taunt enemy soldiers who were trampling your garden, because they could just as easily take out their anger on the enemy, on you, and who would raise a protest? So, flip on. All right, so this is my absolute favorite part of this artifact, the pipe, and that is Permelia's teeth marks on the end of it, because it does help to lend a little bit more personality to it. It shows us, again, this really tough lady who yelled at the Yankees as they came through her yard. And so these sort of household items, whether it be the rolling pin, which, by the way, the other suggestion that I've had for the fate of the handles is that she took it to her second husband's head. But I don't know. It could be perfectly an innocent loss of the handles. But in any case, both of these items show us a household run over by war. We see people totally transformed by what has taken place on their land and by the war at large. And it's a great reminder, as we start to then look for the broader scale, beyond the personal scale, it's a great reminder that in two democracies at war, which is what we have in the Civil War, the citizens matter. So Permelia taunting those Yankee soldiers, that might be the closest she ever gets to the war and having any kind of real contribution, but it's a start. All of the people that are involved in this war have a say. Their opinions matter, because if the home front gives up on the war, you can believe the armies certainly aren't going to stay much longer in the field. So these seemingly domestic symbols, very different natures, each show us active participants in the war who often take matters into their own hands in one way or the other. So here, though, for our demonstration purposes, we have two artifacts that we can see we can ask very basic questions of, or we can start to ask very broad questions of. And things get a lot more interesting and a lot more fun once we start to get to the really broad questions. But it shows us how we face very serious choices when we ask ourselves how we're going to display this artifact. I could simply say, this is a rolling pin from the wilderness battlefield. It belonged to one of the citizens who lived there. And that's a really flat sort of example. You can't really learn much from it. But the way that we present it to you, if we tell you the full story about Permelia, this artifact becomes extremely powerful. And so the way that we see our museums develop, the way that we see our exhibits develop, strongly dependent on the choices that we make as historians to present these to you, the public. Because if I didn't tell you what I know about this artifact, you might never be able to figure it out yourself. So this can lead us to some dangerous ground. How do we decide what to display? How do we decide what stories to tell? How do we decide to tell Permelia's story? Do we talk about her as this awful Yankee hater because really she was? Or do we present her as a woman in crisis and say the best thing she knew how to do was to yell at those people who were trampling her garden? She needed that garden. And there's so many different ways that we can look at this story and so many different ways that we can look at these artifacts. And so to some people, I want to just get this out of the way from the beginning. Some people see this as, oh, museum builders. They must have some overarching conspiracy. They've got this plan laid out, and they're going to dupe us into thinking what they think. And that simply isn't the case. There is no vast government conspiracy to tell you what to think about your past. I can attest, I work for the government. There is no conspiracy. There is, however, a series of decisions that we make that are greatly influenced by the culture that we live in today, the society that we live in, and our own personal views, much as we try to keep them out of this business. So, museums, therefore, become an expression of our popular culture, of our views of the Civil War. And so we'll take a look at a couple examples of museums and how we display things as we continue into sort of the next part of our talk. So, yes, ma'am. The stick? Oh, I'm sorry. That is the stem of the pipe. That's a great question. I should have made that more clear. Yes. Oh, it's the same pipe. The same pipe. It's just a close-up view of the stem of the pipe, which is why I said that that was Permelia's teeth marks in that pipe. That's the stem. Okay. Thank you for asking. Yes. Yeah, that's the end of the pipe. Thank you. All right. Any other questions about the pipe, the rolling pin?
Is the whole pipe wood, or is the bowl clay?
Yeah, the bowl is clay, and it's sort of a reed wood stem. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
My grandmother was born in 1876, and she used her mother's rolling pin. It had no handle.
That's an excellent point. So she just said that it was your grandmother, your mother? Your grandmother used. Right. And it had.
She was born in the 40s, and their rolling pin had. My grandmother always had a lot of flour on her hand. And it was a very heavy rolling pin. It was awfully hard because she then gave it to my mother.
All right, so there is always the chance that the rolling pin actually had no handles. And I think I have seen them even in stores today without handles, interestingly enough. Now, if you do look at the other side, there's a bit of a rough patch in the sort of the center of it, which makes me think that there might have been something there, but we really don't know for sure. It could just be a rough patch on the wood. So that's an excellent point. She may not have broken off the handles on anything. There may not have been handles. So, all right, any other questions, discussion points? No. All right. Let's then take a look at a couple of museum exhibits and how we can use these artifacts. All right. So this is an image of actually from Fredericksburg, from a collection that used to exist in Fredericksburg. This is an advertisement from the Exchange Hotel, and this is an early Civil War museum in the town. It actually was just part of that hotel. It's items that had been collected from the battlefields or purchased from other people who had collected them from the battlefields. And you can see that there isn't much in the way of overwhelming organization. We're not sort of grouping artifacts by where they came from or the stories they can tell. We're just, and by we, I mean the National Park Service had nothing to do with this collection. But we as museum makers had really no sort of organization here. They're displayed with very simple labels, if labeled at all. And sometimes they publish catalogs. This collection actually had a published catalog that went with it. So you could buy this sort of catalog and look through to see a little bit more about each artifact, where it came from, who donated it, that sort of thing. But it's going to be, again, that sort of first layer of questions that we're looking for. So who did it belong to? Where did it come from? That sort of thing. Not necessarily saying, is there a story behind this artifact? Just the bare facts. They're going to emphasize, again, identification, previous ownership, and then any information that's known about it. And the emphasis in these sort of museums is going to be on the quantity of artifacts displayed. You can see that they're very much into arranging things to show, look at how many artillery shells we have. And then also on factual information. So where did this come from? What was this used for? What size of a shell is this? What type of gun is this? All very useful information, but to the layman who's coming to take a look at this, it doesn't mean very much. They don't know the difference between this type of gun and this type of gun. Why does that matter? But at the same time, these sort of collections are developing close enough to the war that information, say, the broader information that we try to include in museums today about the causes of the war, why people were fighting, why people were using certain weapons, wasn't necessarily always necessary. If you've got a veteran in the group that you're visiting this museum with, they can probably tell you the answer. Or they already know it if it's a group of veterans coming to visit. And in this case, for the Exchange Hotel, it often hosted reunions for veterans coming to the battlefields in the Fredericksburg area. So to that purpose, it would work very well. To a modern visitor to walk into this setting, I think we'd all be somewhat lost. We'd think it was cool, but we wouldn't necessarily understand why those artifacts were important.
Now, are the little white blotches, I mean, that far, wouldn't be a pre-admittance, right?
Well, so that was just an advertisement. You could probably walk up to the artifacts, and honestly, at that point in time, they might not have even cared too much if you picked it up.
Right.
So yeah, you would have been able to walk up and look at the labels. But there again, those sort of small labels focusing on the facts of what this artifact was. And you can see this is moving us up to, move us on. Yeah, so this is yet another collection that found its home in Fredericksburg. This is the Tuning Museum, which developed really in the early 30s. So it opened in, I think, 1929, this museum did, in downtown Fredericksburg. And you can see that this looks a little bit more like a museum, but it also looks very much like that early collection that just has a lot of artifacts, some labels, but mostly, again, that sort of factual information. And the heavy emphasis in both of these museums, so you can see this persisting from like the late 1880s through to the 1930s with this museum. You can see that they're really emphasizing the relics themselves. And so when I say relics as opposed to artifacts, what does that call to mind? All right, I've got weapons, time lapse. Do we know of any other sort of artifacts, relics? If we're talking about relics, have you collected relics from elsewhere?
Religious.
All right, so yeah, you want your little fragment of the crown of thorns, say, or this little chip of the cross, right? So relics almost gives these a more holy sort of connotation. Not in the sense that I think anyone would treat these as religious artifacts, but to simply suggest that being with the artifacts, communing with the artifacts, is enough. We don't need sort of the other stories. We don't need to be entertained. We don't need graphics to go with them. The artifacts stand alone. They stand for themselves. And so when we look at relic shows or museums of relics, that's what these museums are going for. That's what their goal is. And you can see that this sort of museum, if you start to go back through writings of this time, so early 20th century writings about the war, these kind of museums are just in keeping with it. A lot of the veterans are writing about their experiences during the war, but they're not writing about it. Some are writing about it in a very sappy sort of way, but a lot of them are writing articles really contesting each other. You think you got closest to the stone wall? Excuse me, we got closest to the stone wall, and I can prove it. And so if you go back through some of their writings of the time, it is really very much a back and forth, and they're focusing on the facts, if they're not being very sentimental, which they are sometimes. But for the most part, they're focusing on the facts. What happened? Let me tell my story. I saw this happen. So again, this sort of makes sense with what our understanding of the Civil War was at the time. But by the later 30s, we start to see a bit more of a shift. We start to see, again, sort of the more formal organization of artifacts to space and stories. So we have this. I'm not sure if any of you would recognize this. Rick?
I recognize part of it.
Recognize part of it. Oh, you see the diorama, right? So these are the exhibits that were put in Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center in the late 30s.
Wow.
I love the tile. But you can see that by the later 30s, you've got a very drastic difference. Now, keep in mind also, this is a difference between a private museum and the National Park Service Museum. So some of that distinction is going to be from your source. But some of it is also in overall style of museums, what people are beginning to expect from a Civil War museum that they're visiting. So you'll see that it's formalized into exhibit case spaces. You'll see that there are stories and images paired with the artifacts. And so while it's still very fact-based, you know, how was this cartridge box used, or here's a rifle, what kind of rifle is it? It is being broken down into distinct subjects and stories that we can talk about. Part of this is because the war is not quite as close. So people who are visiting need that context. They need that explanation. And so if we move on to next, which is one of my favorite photos from the old exhibits, if you look really closely, you'll see that there's a soldier who has strings attached to him, and the strings go off to different pieces of his uniform that are laid down at the bottom of the case. And the title says Soldier Life. So I just think this is really neat in the way that they decided to display it. But it shows us that museums are now putting the pieces together. They're starting to show a little bit more context, starting to show how those relics fit into a larger story. So growing tourism at battle sites and, again, the formalization of these battle sites. So Fredericksburg is, of course, a later addition to the National Park Service repertoire of battlefield sites, but we are starting to grow in visitation by the late 30s. We need museum exhibits to sort of supplement what the staff is doing, and this is the solution. But we do see, when we decide to revise these exhibits, a very fundamental shift. So moving from the late 30s to the late 50s and early 60s, we see a dramatic change. Now, what sort of things might have prompted this change, moving from the late 30s to the late 50s? What's happened in between?
World War II.
Of course, World War II. what's happening to, so that gives us a different perspective on war, firstly. And then secondly, what's happening to our Civil War veterans? They're all dying at this point. By the 60s, I don't think there are any Civil War veterans still alive. So this is a new era, then, of Civil War museums in which you do not have veterans of that war actually coming to visit. And not to mention, your country has just gone through a major war that involved the mobilization of practically the entire country. So that's going to shape how you view a war, even though it's a totally different war. It's going to change things. And so we start to see things change in the 1960s as to how we look at the war. There's also a growth in more formal scholarship as the veterans are no longer able to be the solid voice of what exactly happened during the war. We start to get these great narratives. So I don't know how many of you are Bruce Catton fans or Allen Evans fans. I mean, some spectacular writers, some excellent narrative accounts of what the Civil War was and what it means. There are two elements as you look through that sort of scholarship in the era of the 60s. One is that they tend to agree on the finer points of the war in a rather non-confrontational sort of way. So they sort of address the war in a very smooth kind of way that we tend to refer to as consensus history, meaning that certainly they'll disagree on some things, but largely they're agreeing. They're not talking about controversial things. They're playing nice with each other. You don't really see that in Civil War scholarship today. For the most part, scholars play nice, but attend a conference and they start to sort of snip at each other. But the second element is that they start to separate, and Nevins does this especially, that they separate the Civil War into categories. So you have the military scene, and then you have women's role in the war, and then you have the home front, and then you have the political scene. And so all of these different factors are divided up. And so, interestingly, we see that also in the exhibits that come out of the late 50s and early 60s, that they divide up these other categories. But there's also a growth in the social history world, so we talk more about women's role in the war, and the home front, and camp life, and all these other things that have, in the past, been kind of subsumed under the scholarship of the military scene. Now we're seeing an examination of broader topics. So,
are you also saying
yes,
that a photograph tells better than 1,000 words or whatever, so it gives you something to focus and then kind of gives some meaning to the artifacts involved?
All right, so the question is, are you also seeing a better use of photographs to say, you know, a photograph can convey a lot more, and then you can partner it with an artifact that will tell you an even greater story? And I would say yes. You'll see in this exhibit very well that they have several images associated with the artifacts as well, and that very much helps to lend to the examination of these artifacts. But so in the end, what you see, an excellent point about the photographs, is that the artifacts are no longer the story, they're part of a story. And they're helping to move that story along, but they're no longer standalone themselves. So we are going to now engage in a bit of a comparison between two of our 1960s era exhibits. So bear with me, we're going to look at one case called The Union Soldier and one case called Lee's Men, and those are their titles above. This is the 1960s attempt at equal representation. And so if you look back through their museum documentation of what they write, the Men in Gray proposal, which was the original title for Lee's Men, said the uniform to be worn by the Confederate soldier was set forth in Army regulations. The difficulty was, however, that very few Confederate soldiers were ever issued a complete uniform, and when an item was lost or worn out, the ingenuity of the soldier determined the character of the replacements. This exhibit would show the authorized uniform and the typical infantryman. So the goal, basically, to show the average Confederate soldier. For Men in Blue, the original title for the Union soldier, was designed, as the literature said, this exhibit is to show the uniform and equipment of the Civil War soldier. It will first show what was issued to the soldier and then indicate the articles discarded. So they're showing, again, the typical Union soldier and then trying to sort of emphasize how the Union soldier also changed his uniform. So we'll take a look. So here we have the Union soldier case, and We've just dismantled these very recently. But up until a couple months ago, if you had come to the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center, this is exactly what you would see. So we've got the Union soldier with a rifle, a haversack, a jacket, a hat, a knapsack, and an overcoat. This is articles, of course, typical for a Union soldier. And then we have Lee's men. I apologize for the quality of this photo. But in Lee's men, we've got some other articles. We've got a jacket, a rifle, a blanket, a vest, a couple canteens, some other accoutrements. So a bit of a difference. So what differences stand out to you all? I know it's hard to see in the photo. All right, so the Union soldier was better equipped and had more uniform pieces. All right.
Sorry, was it? They'd be warmer.
Looked like the Union soldier would be warmer.
Yeah.
Because he had the overcoat, which certainly helps to lend to that idea. What else?
Is it safe to say that the Union soldier was given too much equipment? He was given too, sort of overloaded because they discard things as soon as they had to march.
All right, so there's the question. Is it safe to say that the Union soldier was given too much to carry? And I would say it probably is. But it's interesting that you should bring that up, because you want to move on to the next slide. If we compare these side by side, there's actually more in the Confederate case. But you have... partly because it's in the South. That's a very good point. Certainly, Confederate artifacts were easier to come by for these displays, although they did have some trouble getting a uniform, as they noted. But you'll notice that the Confederates have more, but if you can read, and I'm sure you can't read from here, so I will read it to you. The quotation that is underneath the title of the Union soldier, it says, "Bowed under 58 pounds of army essentials, our private was a soldier, but not just then a praiser of the soldier's life." So your all's impression of this soldier who's kind of overburdened with things and carrying way too much and therefore has to discard some of it is exactly the sort of framework that these designers are trying to give you. Now, interestingly, is taking a look at the Confederate case and its quotation, which says, "No soldiers ever marched with less to encumber them, and none marched harder or faster." So, yes, ma'am. Excellent point. So you just said there's a difference in the titles. One says the Union soldier, and the other says Lee's men. Who's commanding the Union soldier? He doesn't have a commander, apparently. And certainly, yeah, the difficulty is that the Union Army, especially at this point, the Army of the Potomac is kind of a revolving door. So perhaps part of what they were trying to convey was there is a sense of, you know, solid leadership in the Confederate Army under Lee. You don't really have that in the Union soldier. At the same time, that doesn't necessarily lend to your goal of equal representation when you don't have sort of side-by-side Union soldier, the Confederate soldier. There's a little bit of a difference there. So excellent, excellent observation. The other thing that you'll notice, if we start to actually list the materials that are in each case, the Union soldier has, and I've already done this to some degree, overcoat, jacket, knapsack, rifle, hat. Confederate soldier, Lee's man, has jacket, blanket, vest, rifle, bayonet, revolver, cap pouch, two canteens, buckles, and buttons, various. So who's really overloaded here? Interestingly, the Confederate case has far more, and it is worth saying that as a museum in the South, it makes sense that the Confederate case would have more because there are simply more Confederate artifacts to be found. At the same time, if you take a look at the artifacts that are on display here, we get the impression that Union soldiers are encumbered and cold. Well, they're warm since they've got their overcoat. Confederates are lean, traveled lightly, and were armed to the teeth. He's got a rifle, a bayonet, a knife, and a revolver in his one case. So we get an interesting sort of difference in views once you start to strip these cases down. You also have, as a sidebar, you might notice there's an individual photograph of a Confederate soldier in the Lee's Men case. This is Randolph Fairfax, who, according to the exhibit, typifies the young manhood that both sides lost in the war. But it's worth saying that although they say that both sides lost in the war, they only have an example of it in the Confederate case. So, I would posit that between these two cases, we have an excellent example of museum designers with all the best of intentions who somehow find themselves in a position where they are still not exactly providing the balance that they were potentially initially looking for, whether it be defined by the artifacts that they can get a hold of, or even by their own ideas, even if they're sort of subconscious or undercurrents that led them to have such a difference in their two cases here, despite their attempts at equal representation. But moving on, we see another example of how culture and society at the time have influenced how these cases develop. So this case that we're looking at is Women in the War. So it's again sort of touching on that social history that's growing during this time in Civil War scholarship by giving the women their own case. They do have a role in the war, and in some ways it's almost impressive that the Visitor Center actually has this in the 1960s. It's rather innovative for them. At the same time, you'll notice that they have their own case very much separate from the military style cases. In fact, these are in separate rooms. The Union and Confederate soldier is in a separate room along with some artillery shells, a small arms collection, well, long arms collection, and this is in a separate case, or a separate room, alongside camp life cases. So we have this clear distinction between military life, camp life, women, etc., all in a separate room. In this case, we see a bullet mold. We see a mini ball wrapped up as a full cartridge, handmade by a lady from town. We also have various other pieces of things to represent the roles that women supposedly had during the Civil War. And I'm not going to tell you that this case is not true, because the roles that it tells you are in fact roles that women had during the war. So the interesting thing, though, is the way that these roles are described. So the caption here, the primary caption, says, "Most watched and waited, their busy hands producing items needed to keep the armies in the field. A few performed heroically on or near the battle lines." That's true in many wars, but as this case is being designed, what war do you think is foremost in people's minds? Korea, certainly. And what else?
Support.
Support. So, right, so what kind of roles are women taking on in Korea? They're taking on nursing roles. So, of course, we're going to talk about Clara Barton here because it's something that people can identify with. There also might be thinking, hearkening back to World War II, where we've got sort of the Rosie the Riveter mentality of women taking up roles that men had left behind. And certainly you do have that in several different wars, especially the Civil War. You do have several women who are stepping into men's roles. But it's interesting. But yes.
In the larger picture, are they sewing? I can't really tell what they are.
The larger picture, great question, is kind of a conglomeration of roles. So it's nursing, so it's women writing letters in a nursing sort of role. They are sewing in the top portion of it. It's just a mixture of the different roles that they saw that women could have from an illustration of the time. So you do have this blending, interestingly in this case, of pieces of Civil War history from the time, certainly all facts of what women did, but blended sort of through this prism, this lens, if you will, of Korea and World War II, the ideas that people are familiar with and the ideas that people know. So you think about this. At the same time, we have one of the most interesting artifacts in this case is that cartridge wrapped by Miss Molly Welford. I wish we knew more about the cartridge made by Miss Molly Welford, but instead of focusing, say, on that cartridge and figuring out what sort of stories we could tell from what was Molly Welford's life, what made her decide to participate in wrapping up homemade cartridges for the men on the front, we're taking much more of a national lens, which I think speaks, again, to the other influences on these exhibit designers. But our case studies aside, this tells us a little bit, again, just a glimpse of how society and culture is reflected back to us through our museum exhibits. There's some glaring omissions in these exhibits from the 1960s to our modern eyes. There's no mention, as you walk throughout them, of slavery or emancipation. But the Battle of Fredericksburg happened after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation was issued and before the actual document itself was signed on January 1st. It's actually a major reason that the Battle of Fredericksburg is fought, but you won't find even the Emancipation Proclamation mentioned once in these exhibits. You won't notice that despite the sort of small differences between the Union case and the Confederate case, the rifles don't even point at each other. There is nothing that distinguishes really what these men were fighting for. So you see, there's almost a nationalistic trend here that neither side was wrong. There is no clear right and wrong. And of course, in an exhibit today, you're not going to find anyone saying, hey, those guys were wrong, because the Civil War is such a contested idea. But you will find that there was bitterness between those two sides, and you will see no evidence of bitterness in these exhibit cases. You can't really tell why the men were fighting each other. It seems like they would have gotten along. So why, then, is this the case? Why is there no mention of emancipation or slavery? Well, what's happening in the early 60s? Civil rights movement. In the midst of the civil rights movement, are you going to talk about slavery? Are you going to talk about emancipation? I would hope that I would have the courage to, but I'm not really sure that I would. Is that really a band-aid you want to rip off when someone comes to visit your battlefield? Not necessarily. So they avoid it. As for the nationalistic lens, well, we're also in the midst of the Cold War. Are you going to talk about internal divisions when we've got an enemy abroad? Probably not. And so you can understand why those certain decisions were made. They might not have even been conscious decisions. But who's going to suggest that we talk about slavery? Who's going to suggest that we mention the Emancipation Proclamation when you know the baggage that comes with it? Of course, to our modern eyes, there's a great difference. But then again, we are no longer a segregated park. It's also important to note, when these exhibits go in, segregation exists in the very park that they're being placed in. We have separate bathrooms. Yes, ma'am?
Well, I was going to ask if these were open to black people at the time.
That's a great question. So the question is, were these open to black people at the time? I'm not entirely sure. I believe that they were. I'm still trying to work my way through just where the lines were of what was permitted for black and white people in the park, because we did have separate bathrooms at the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center. They are working, as part of the proposal that actually brought us these exhibits, they're working to try to have separate picnic areas at various parts of the battlefield. I suspect, though we haven't been able to find concrete evidence, that there was already separate picnic areas on the Fredericksburg battlefield for black and white visitors at the time. Were they permitted to walk through the exhibits? I'm not sure.
Weren't there separate, like on Skyline Drive at that period, a park that was made for blacks, a park for blacks?
Right, the question is, in Shenandoah on Skyline Drive, were there separate parks essentially for blacks and whites? I'm not as familiar with Shenandoah, but I can say from going through their exhibits that they did have at least a separate contact station or separate spot for black visitors to stop at as opposed to white visitors to stop at. So it's an excellent point. This is the sort of culture that you want to bring a discussion of slavery into. Potentially, it's what was needed. At the same time, your museum exhibits aren't exactly an agent of social change, unless you want them to be. Which brings us, of course, to larger questions for today, which we're not going to ask quite yet. But in thinking about how we approach exhibits today, and so sort of the conclusion of this is that I want you all to think about the exhibits that you go through and see on a regular basis. You all, as very interested people, I'm sure, go to museums all the time. So how does our society reflect the things that we display in a museum and the stories that we tell? So think about what's changed over the last 50 years to figure out how our impressions of the Civil War will have changed by the exhibits that we are installing as I speak. Post-Vietnam, how do we view war? It's going to be the same way we did immediately after World War II or during the Korean conflict. I think it's going to be very different. We are currently engaged in a very long-term war. However, it doesn't generally impact the mass population. It's a war that's really only impacting a select subset of that population. So how do we as a society approach war today? What about those racial issues? Certainly we don't have segregation anymore in our parks, but do we still confront racial issues on a regular basis? The answer there is yes. And how do we confront those issues? Do we confront them in our museum exhibits? Our answer is going to be yes to that question. But then how do we address that? That's a very delicate line to walk. And so as we begin to make these certain decisions, I would say that we are a lot more open with our conversations in general. We like to ask more questions, and we ask more difficult questions in the museums that you'll see today. And the more relevant, or the more recent a museum is, of course, their goal is to be more relevant, and also to some degree to push the envelope a little bit more. But there's still evidence of hesitation. So I'm going to ask, and I know pretty much know the answer to this question, how many of you have been to Monticello? All right. So I'm going to preface everything I say by saying I recently visited Monticello after having not seen it since I was 6 years old, and it was fantastic. I know, I was really excited. Jefferson is a wonderful man, brilliant. I was floored. But my question is, and one of the things that I, as a visitor, was very interested in looking into was how they addressed the Sally Hemings question. Because I'll be the first to admit, I don't know the answer to the Sally Hemings question. I haven't done enough research to really form a well-formed opinion. And I was very much hoping that when I went to Monticello, I would be equipped with a little more information to make that decision. What does Monticello say about Sally Hemings?
Nothing. Monticello says that more than likely, Esten Hemings, her youngest son, more than likely was fathered by Thomas Jefferson.
All right. So he said that Esten Hemings was more than likely fathered by Thomas Jefferson.
Seems highly likely.
So what I found in going through the exhibits at Monticello was one line that I found in probably three places that said, many historians believe that there was this relationship potentially between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. The same line, however. Don't the docents tell the story? They did tell the story, but it was remarkably similar to the same line that I read in the exhibits, which was the same line that I read in other exhibits.
Docents are actually required to tell the story.
Required to tell the full story?
No.
To tell a version of the story. So you see, okay. So docents are required to tell a version of the story. That is great to know because, see, we are addressing the question, aren't we? Talking about it, but how are we talking about it? Because that's the other side of the question here. And I'm certainly not here to pick on Monticello. I'm sure they have excellent reasons behind their decision, as do most historical institutions, and they've probably thought it out very well, how they want to address this very sensitive topic. But it's interesting to see us at something of a crossroads. We are talking about this issue, but are we very comfortable with delving all the way into it? Do we want to jump in with both feet? And that is a real question. I'm not saying that is a leading question that we should. It's a real question. Should we jump in with both feet? Especially on a case like Sally Hemings, where can we really say 100% sure that this is what happened? I can say it's more than likely. Rather likely, perhaps. But that's just one example. And you'll notice also that style-wise, museums are changing. So we've talked about sort of the progression from stacks of relics to organized cases to very organized cases around photographs and stories. But now, you'll see, if you'll move us forward a slide, now you'll see, this is an example from the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico. I hope that most of you have been there. It's a fantastic museum if you have not. You'll see that there's this desire to immerse visitors in an environment that can help to tell the story. We want to elicit an emotional and an intellectual connection by making people a part of the scene, by not putting everything from the past behind glass, but by putting people into that historical scene, we think that they'll be able to much better engage with things. The history is not past and totally separate from the present. It might be past, but it's also very connected to the present. And so we'll put you into that scene to try to make that point. If you're looking for this kind of experience on a Civil War topic, I highly recommend Pamplin Park. They're probably the closest that I've seen to getting to the sort of immersive experience. But Pamplin Park? Pamplin Historical Park is in Petersburg, Virginia. It's not a national park site. It's a privately run park, but it is very excellent. So they also have part of the earthworks from the Petersburg battlefield. So if you want to see the whole Petersburg battlefield that's preserved, you want to go to Pamplin Park anyway. But do go through their exhibits. But again, so we see this question, how do we tell the story of our artifacts? How do we tell the story of our battlefields and our past? Ultimately, our stronger stories and themes have only grown. That approach to say we're going to organize our artifacts into these storylines and to address these certain themes, that's the sort of style that has grown through the years. And so one of the interesting examples also that I was able to draw out of the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center exhibits is that Confederate uniform that they wanted to put on display in that case. It isn't actually the uniform that they did put on display, but it's the one that they had in their collection when they were planning this display. They lamented that it was incomplete, and they said, "We have a complete Confederate uniform. The soldier who wore it had one leg shot off and, unfortunately, had his pants on at the time." So I read that, and I thought, they must be joking. But then I thought about it. Their goal was not to tell this soldier's story. Their goal was to show average Confederate uniform. I believe he meant that, unfortunately, this Confederate soldier had his pants on when his leg was shot off. We now have that on display as the story of the soldier, William Hightower, who it is one of the most moving things to stare at that uniform and realize that the surgeons actually cut his pants off as they amputated his leg and he did not survive the experience. Yes. 24th Virginian. Your memory is better than mine. I knew that he was Virginian, but I will take your word for it that he's 24th, you said? Yes, William Hightower. So we are more than happy to tell his story now. We want to display that as sort of this changing trend. We want to talk about William Hightower and his experience in the war, how that changed him, how that's reflective on society. And so you see us trying to address these questions, trying to tell this broader story as well as a more personal story. And so there's a distinct difference between how we view, explore, and experience the Civil War today than there was even 50 years ago, especially 100 years ago, let alone 150 years ago. But the question I want to leave you all with is how then do the arrangement of artifacts and stories and themes reflect a culture or a society? And then what does the exhibits that you'll see as you go on with your museum visiting careers, what does that tell us about today's society? If you look at museum exhibits that you visit in the next couple weeks, do you see your reflection in those exhibits? So, with that, I want to thank you all again for the opportunity to speak. And then, of course, any questions? Yes, sir.
I have one comment which did not seem to appear at all, is today we're trying to attract more of the children. And we just had the Ryle Hill exhibit a band or whatever. And they had lots of hand paintings on today. And Monticello has gotten into a lot more of that, rather than just telling the story and so forth, trying to have children participate or see.
Yes, that's an excellent point. Right, so we are actively trying to appeal to children, and it's a very hard thing to write an exhibit for children, unless that's what you do as a specialty. But you're right, you'll see more hands-on sort of trying to engage the senses, and I'll admit that hands-on things appeal not only to children, but also to adults. I find hands-on exhibits extremely appealing, and we refer to those things as manual interactives, when you can, lift the barrel. There's got to be a fancy word for everything. But, when you can lift up the barrel and smell what's inside. Mount Vernon does that. You can smell the different products. That's fantastic. But it really does appeal to people when you can manually interact with things. So, yes, ma'am.
Well, there's a part of the soldier's life that astonishes me every time I read about it, but I don't know if anybody has an exhibit that explains this. Is there ever an exhibit that explains what it's like to go 6 months without a bath, or to be infested with all sorts of types of ticks and mice and fleas and things? And is there anything?
Maybe at Andersonville.
Oh, that's a good point. So,
but what it's like to march all day from Harper's Ferry to Sharpsburg and then have to fight. You know, to go without food for 3 days and then have to fight. I mean, these are things that you might read about them in memoirs or diaries or things like that, but usually it's all glory and these troops moved there and the cannons went off over here and things like that, but you don't understand the misery of the everyday.
Right. That's an excellent point, that the hardships of the soldier you often don't see, because most places that have museums are going to be preserved places. Most preserved places tend to be battlefields or areas where there was significant action. You don't see as much in the way of campsites preserved and so forth. So I would say, since you're looking for exhibits to talk about this, to some degree that Pamplin might be able to help, because they are supposed to be the Museum of the Common Soldier or something to that effect is their sort of subtitle. But I'm not sure that I remember seeing anything in there that spoke directly to misery. There was much to camp life and a little bit of misery, but not necessarily to the degree that you're talking about. But your point about Andersonville is also a good one, because they see themselves, or their mission is to be the National Museum for Prisoners of War. So they get the prisoner of war experience, and they are not a battle site. Their mission, and I've never been to Andersonville, but their mission is to explain what it is like to be a prisoner of war, and you can imagine that's a miserable experience. And from what I've heard, their museum is very powerful, so it might be a good place to check out. So, yes?
I find many of the modern museums start, I think more like, maybe it's my age, but like that first museum where there was a whole lot of things, you could see a whole lot. And now there's a lot of reading, or you push buttons and you hear something. But it seems like they must have an awful lot of storage that they're just not showing. You just don't see the actual items the way that we used to.
Yes, that's an excellent point. The museums are going more and more toward slimmed down amounts of artifacts on display. And that is a product of sort of this changing way of interpreting our artifacts. And to some degree, it's very good, because it does tell us, it gives us the opportunity to explore individual stories, to focus and highlight the really key artifacts. But you're right in the sense that you don't get as much of the experience to see as much in the way of artifacts, and to have that sort of experience where you say, this was actually here. And that experience is also extremely important. So we want our exhibits to be informational, but we also want to provide visitors with the opportunity to, it might sound silly, but to commune with the past, to say, this artifact saw this. It saw, I don't know how many terrible days. This rifle, I don't want to think about how many people it killed. You don't get that experience if we don't have those on display. So it is a trend. You're definitely right about that, for better or for worse. And there are, again, some benefits and some negatives to it. And there is an awful lot in storage in most museums.
Yes.
So, yes.
One of the things that, as you were talking, I was thinking about that since both sides in the Civil War conscripted people, and you were talking about museums in the 60s, and we have the draft cards being burned and so on, that it's interesting that that wasn't kind of tied together, tied in modern context.
All right, so your point about conscription, because you do have several soldiers, especially in the later part of the Civil War, you know, you've got a large number of soldiers who are conscripted, but you keep in mind that I will yield to anyone who knows differently, because my area of expertise is mostly the Civil War and not Vietnam or Korea. But my understanding is that most of that unrest is going to come, say, after 1956, probably. Is that a... So So yeah. These exhibits are being planned more in the 56, 57, 58 time frame. So I would say that probably isn't as large of an issue. One of the other things that's most likely playing into why you don't have a larger discussion of conscription, firstly, much like the civil rights movement, do you necessarily, as the federal government, want to weigh in on that discussion? And then secondly, we have this view of wars past, a lot of times is a very rosy view, and I would say that in the 60s, we had a rather rosy view of the Civil War. If you read Catton, again, you're going to get this, you know, not that it's all glory, but a lot of it is. And I think there's, certainly people will admit that there's a large number of people who are conscripted, but when you think about the armies, and I'll admit that I do this too, my perception is largely that these are volunteer armies.
Right.
It's not always the case, but that is sort of the popular notion that, that, of course, in the Civil War, you know, Farmer Joe decided to sign up for his cause, not that Farmer Joe was conscripted and couldn't afford to pay a substitute. So perhaps, and it's worth taking a look at, museums from the mid-70s, do they address this? I don't know. That's a great point, though. So, yes, ma'am.
Does it seem that as we get farther in time away from this, that we can be a little more honest because emotions aren't as raw? I mean,
all right.
There's some things that if you'd have brought up very close to the Civil War, you'd have had a fight on your hands when certain people came through. And as you get a little more away from it, we can look at it with a different view and maybe a little more honest.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So the question is that, is it because so much time has passed that we're able to be a little bit more honest or a little bit more analytical about what happened during the Civil War? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. And one of the things that I most appreciate about being a historian of the Civil War during the 150th anniversary is that I feel like we're on the cusp of being almost entirely honest, but we still aren't quite there yet. So I can't tell you how many visitors come into our visitor center with muddled notions of the causes of the war, or just there's a lot of elements of the war that are not settled for a lot of people. But to some people, it is. Say, if we had a discussion about what caused the Civil War in the academic world, the answer, slavery. I mean, you can talk about it I don't know how many ways, but the end answer is slavery. You ask the general public what caused the Civil War, probably going to get split right down the middle, slavery and states' rights. So we're still having that conversation, and that's part of what makes this so much fun, that we can still talk about it. It isn't set in stone. It isn't something that we fully understand and have agreed upon. So, however, if we tried to have this conversation 20 years ago, would we have even had the conversation? 50 years ago, I'm pretty sure we would not have had the conversation. So the farther away we get, yeah, the more we are able to talk about it, I think. Yes, in the back. Yes.
We have been here for 30 years, but we are from the north, and we went quite a while ago, soon after we came, to some of these museums, Newmarket, we have been to Bedford, and you would hardly know that the north won. We're in a country now, and yet
what was that?
When we got out of Newmarket, I said, "Oh my gosh, I'm sorry, the North won. That was Stonewall Jackson and all." So is maybe just in some ways it's a little bit unavoidable because of course there are more southern artifacts and things here. Now, has that changed recently or can it change?
All right.
And
so,
one more thing, not to talk too
sure.
much, but
oh, you're
recently
fine.
I went on a tour with the museum and we went to the Commonwealth Club in Richmond. And you wouldn't even know that the North existed. So I think it does need to be somehow evened out a little bit, but
all right. Yeah, so for any of you who didn't hear, the overall point was that these fine people are from the North. Me too. It's okay. And being, West Virginia is a little contested, but I am technically north of the Mason-Dixon line. But in any case, being from the north, you come here, especially 20, 30 years ago, you're going to find an extremely heavy southern sort of Confederate leanings. And even still today, you go to places and you see that. And some of it is the sheer logical reasoning that, of course, this is the South. You are in the South. There are more artifacts that are preserved because families are passing these artifacts down. That was, you know, my great-great-granddaddy's rifle. So, of course, I still have it, and I still live in Virginia, so I'm keeping it. And then some of it is also going to be the influence, of course, if we want to go kind of broader memory studies of the Lost Cause, which is, of course, all those tenets that say, of course, the North shouldn't have won, or the South never had a chance, or the South had these excellent heroes, not to say that they weren't, but they had these excellent heroes that we put on a beyond human level in Lee and Jackson. To clarify, I find them admirable, but on a human level. So you're right. The trend, I think, is moving a little bit away from that, but you'll still find it in some places. Part of the difference, I think, is where did you all move from?
Well, Pennsylvania, but we're originally New Yorkers.
All right, so New York and Pennsylvania. I'm from northern West Virginia. We're moving down. The Yankees are invading again. And the more that the Yankees invade the South and the more that Southerners invade the North, the more that these sections are going to commingle, we're going to realize that each other does not have horns, that we're all actually okay, and that maybe it's time to let go. And I think, even though I, to some degree, want people to hold on because that's part of what makes this so interesting, you're going to see the more that people geographically relocate, I think more of a balancing of that story. Yes, ma'am?
Well, just to address what she said a little bit, it just, you know, the whole state of Virginia was a battlefield.
Oh, yeah.
And so the memories are in the soil, and the artifacts are in the soil. And you have to think that if the two places in the north, Sharpsburg and Gettysburg, they celebrate the Civil War. I mean, they have their battlefields and their museums and all of those things. I think it's just sort of something that's going to occur if you were part of the big war.
Sure. And so the point is that, of course, most of Virginia was a battlefield and overrun by these armies, and that is extremely important to remember. I think maybe I told you all this story at some point, but one of my most distinct memories of working at the park was a day at Chatham Manor, which is, of course, a pre-war plantation, in which I was working by myself and couldn't give a full tour, but a lady came through and was just looking around, and I asked her if she'd seen the Civil War graffiti that we have in the house, and she said, "No, I didn't, but I'm not surprised. Those Yankees did, you know, I'm not surprised that those Yankees did that." And then she slammed the door and walked out. And I was sort of like, oh, well, I'm not going to tell you where I'm from, firstly. But then secondly, I don't think they did it to your house, but you talk just like they did. You know, and I respect that lady because, you know, she has her views and she believes them very strongly, and I fully respect that, and I find it extremely interesting. But it's an important reminder to all of us, especially us Yankees, who did not have our silver stolen and our walls written on, and that part of the reason the South remembers and has held on to this for so long is that they were the ones who suffered these deprivations. And so, yes, if your great-granddaddy's silver collection or his best hunting piece was stolen by the Yankees, you're going to remember that a lot longer than even if Uncle Bob never came back. Uncle Bob never came back, so you never had to live with the fact that he never came back. But if your silver's gone, your silver's gone. Your slaves are gone. How are you rebuilding? Your farm is demolished. Your garden is trampled. How are you rebuilding? And so, to Southerners, it is, to some degree, a lot more personal because it was more personal to them. Not to say that both sides didn't have immense losses, but the South is losing its men and its property. The North is largely losing its men. So, yes,
ma'am? Westerners have a whole different idea. What war was that? You know?
Indeed. One of our colleagues retired to Oregon, and he just came back to visit recently and said, you know, in Oregon, no one talks about the Civil War. They have no idea what I'm talking about. So, yes, ma'am?
Yeah, I'd say that I'm a Yankee, came down to New York State. And as I understand, a Yankee, if you're just visiting, fine. Say you're a damn Yankee.
I've always preferred carpetbagger to that, actually. But I like to think that, Yankees are welcome in some places. Right. Any other?
I run into a few people, you know, that from the South. Like I worked in a doctor's office when I was down in New Orleans, and one of the patients said she was doing a research on the family, and her father was real upset to find there was a Yankee someplace in the
There's one in every family, at least. Yes, sir.
About that, my grandfather was asked one time, my last name is Meade, by the way, was asked if we were kin to General George Meade. He thought about it a little bit, and he said, well, I'm not really sure, but let's not try and find out. Another thing was, the first time I came to face with the fact that the war was not all pretty was, I guess, when I went to the Confederate Museum in Richmond, and we toured Jefferson Davis's house, and then we also went to that, and there was a gentleman there that was dressed in uniform or whatever, and he was telling us about camp life and things, and it didn't sound real good.
Yeah, camp life was not really good. I said camp life was not really good.
Oh, that's when I realized how bad it really was, and that, you know, that's not something that had been brought out, and I'd never faced that before.
Right, which brings up a whole other set of questions, and one of the reasons I would love to go to Andersonville, say, is to see how they address the idea of so many soldiers, and as they're commemorating the 150th anniversary of soldiers being in their prison, they've got a daily count. How many prisoners are there? How many prisoners have died? How many prisoners? So it's in their visitor center. You confront it as soon as you walk in. How many prisoners are there? How many prisoners have died? And I forget the other statistics that they have, but how do you interpret and help to understand that the majority of Civil War soldiers did not die on the battlefield, that they died of disease, and that that death is every bit as honorable as a death on the battlefield? These are still people who died for their cause, but they didn't die at the head of their men charging against a position. How do you talk about that? How do you talk about how inglorious camp life was? How do you celebrate someone who died of dysentery? How do you talk about dysentery to visitors? So there's a whole series of questions that you have to, and really challenges you have to confront in understanding camp life and its hardships.
One other thing was, yep. When you were looking at the boxes of the two soldiers,
yes,
have you compared that to something in a Northern Museum?
I have not.
The contrast or the similarities?
Right. So the question is, have I compared those to exhibit cases with any sort of similar ones in the North? And my biggest challenge is that our exhibits are horrifically old. So our exhibits, being from the 1960s, are true representations of 1960s era interpretation. I would love to, say, go to Gettysburg and dig through their archives of what their exhibits used to look like, see if they had any similar sort of exhibit side-by-side comparison, because that could be fascinating. Yep. Is their Yankee also overloaded? Is their rebel, however, not armed to the teeth? You know, or are these perceptions that were nationwide, that your rebels are traveling light and armed to the teeth and your Yankees are overburdened and leaderless? It's a great question, and I simply don't know.
I wish I still had the article, but there was an article that we have historical, and one of the from our county was the Civil War, and he went to Andersonville, but he survived.
Good for him, yes. People. Lucky.
He was down to, I don't know how many ounces when he got out, but he did survive.
I imagine he was pretty thin.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So, yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say, at Gettysburg and Antietam, you do get a feeling of both sides of those battlefields. I don't remember an exhibit such as the one you mentioned, but at Gettysburg, it's mostly the battlefield. But you do, don't you think, agree that you do get both sides there because they're both further north?
Sure. Well, and one of the interesting parts to me, again, is that this was an attempt to show both sides. That I really think that our exhibit designers in the 1960s thought they were being balanced. And if you don't start to look too closely, you might think they were being balanced as well.
Well, of course, that maybe was balanced for the 1960s.
That's a good point. Perhaps it was balanced for the 1960s. Thank you. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.